Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, on the eve of Pope Benedict's visit to Cyprus, we look ahead to some of the issues on his agenda, including a meeting with Catholic leaders from across the Middle East region. And witnessing to Christ today. The head of the Catholic delegation to the World Missionary Conference in Edinburgh shares his hopes for this important ecumenical encounter. On Friday, Pope Benedict sets off for his 16th pastoral pilgrimage abroad. He'll be spending 3 days on the divided island of Cyprus, meeting with the tiny Catholic community there and launching the working document for next October's Synod of Bishops on the Middle East. Reconciliation throughout the region, Catholic-Muslim dialogue and relations with the majority Orthodox Church there will be three major themes on the Pope's agenda as he touches down in Paphos on the west coast of the island. From there, he travels to the capital Nicosia, divided since 1974 by the UN-patrolled Green Line, separating the Turkish and Greek Cypriot parts of the island. In Nicosia, he'll be staying at the Nunciature inside the UN buffer zone, in the Holy Cross Convent run by the Franciscan Custody of the Holy Land.
Of course, it is a great honour for us, for the Franciscan Friars of the Custody of the Holy Land to host the Holy Father. And indeed, it is a great honour to host the Holy Father's ambassador at all times.
Father David Yeager is the representative to the Holy See of the Franciscan Custody of the Holy Land. He talked to my colleague Charles Collins about the main aims of this papal visit to Cyprus.
It is a tremendous opportunity for the Church throughout the Middle East to be together, to compare notes, as it were, to find the commonalities, to distinguish the differences, and to plan for the future of Christian witness in the region where Christianity was born. I personally would like to see it in continuity with the courageous vision of Pope John Paul II in his speech to a juridical conference in Rome on the 11th of December 1993, when he foresaw a very different future for the Church in the Eastern Mediterranean, one of freedom, a coming of age, a passage from the centuries of being a protected, though isolated, minority into a future where Christians are equal citizens with all their neighbors, and the Church herself enjoys the freedom she claims she needs for the proclamation of the gospel. Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, is a uniquely privileged place for both the papal visit and as a symbolic launching pad for the synod, because it is where Europe and the Middle East meet. Cyprus is now a member of the European Union, underscoring and firming up its belonging to Europe. At the same time, geographically, it is extremely close to the shores of the Eastern Mediterranean and is much frequented by people from the different Mediterranean countries. So it is sans pareil, as they would say in French, as a meeting place.
If we look at the countries which are covered under the synod, we have Iran, Turkey, Cyprus, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Yemen, Qatar, Bahrain, Jordan, and Egypt. And all those countries, only Cyprus would you say that the Church enjoys actually freedom. Why is it that 20 years after the end of the Cold War, we haven't seen freedom in the Middle East come up?
The answer to this must make many distinctions. With the exception of Iran, the rest of those countries somehow or other are still influenced by the heritage of the Ottoman Empire. In the Ottoman Empire, the policy towards the Christian churches was influenced by the monistic conception of society and the state, where religious minorities could exist on sufferance, but within certain limits. Iran, of course, is a different case, but reflects an analogous heritage. Cyprus is radically different in that a majority, a distinct majority, a large majority of its population is Christian, and indeed belongs to a European nation, culture, and language, although it faces the challenge of coexisting with a Muslim Turkish minority, a challenge that has not yet been definitively resolved, but where we see signs for progress. Throughout the rest of the Middle East, progress towards freedom cannot be magical. There are no walls there that can be felled. There are rather processes of development towards democracy, which concern, or towards a more perfect democracy, which concern those societies as a whole, with Christians being, in the end, the beneficiaries alongside many others. So the question there is not the question of treatment of Christians as such in the first place, but of the quality of democracy throughout those societies.
Going back more to the specific aspect of the trip to Cyprus, this is, as you just said, a majority Orthodox country. There are about 7,000 Catholics on the island, the majority of those being Maronite Catholics. The Latin Catholics are under the care of the custody of the Holy Land. The Holy Father himself will be staying at the old Annuncio to Cyprus, which is also in a monastery of the custody of the Holy Land. How has this the preparations been going for the Pope's visit to Cyprus, especially with regards to the custody?
I can assure you that preparations have been very, very intensive in order to adapt the environment of the monastery and the seat of the nunciature within it to the event and to the guest and those who accompany him. I would say this, that the monastery and Church of Holy Cross are themselves at a symbolic spot in divided Nicosia. They are in the UN-controlled neutral zone, right between the Greek Cypriot, that is the independent Cypriot, and the Turkish-ruled areas of Nicosia. So the monastery itself has been the bearer of a mission to reconcile, to provide a place of meeting.
How hard is this division on the people of Cyprus, and what do you think the Pope's visit will do to draw attention to the ongoing division of the island?
Yes, I do not think that the papal visit should be made to appear in any way as if it had the purpose of advocating for one side rather than the other in the Cypriot, in the ongoing, although at present, thank God, nonviolent Cypriot conflict. There are refugees on both sides of the dividing line, and there are claims for property or reparation on both sides of the dividing line. Obviously, each side thinks it has been wronged the most, but right now, all of this is much less important than it might have been just several years ago, because the present situation in Cyprus is one of hope and of progress towards a resolution. The human consequences of the division of the island have been mitigated to a visible extent in recent times by easier passage of people and goods, and these people-to-people contacts are a sign of the possibility of a political solution for the future of the island as well. It has given the greatest push to reconciliation that Cyprus, the Republic of Cyprus, not just one territory of Cyprus, but the Republic of Cyprus, has become a member of the European Union, so that the entire problematics of Cyprus is now adopted by the European Union, which necessarily has a duty to work together with Cyprus and with Turkey to bring about a new united regime in Cyprus that would safeguard the rights of both the majority and the minority communities.
Another aspect of this trip to Cyprus is, of course, an ecumenical one. The Holy Father was not just invited by the president of Cyprus, he was also invited by the Greek Orthodox bishop of Cyprus. And in fact, in his 3 days, will be spending a lot of his time with the Greek Orthodox bishop of Cyprus. There's been a lot of progress in the last couple of years in the Orthodox Catholic dialogue. How significant is this visit, that's the first visit of Pope Benedict to a majority Orthodox country, in that dialogue? And how does this relate to the situation in the Middle East, primarily in the area around the Holy Land, where you do have a lot of Catholics and Orthodox living together?
I think it is a sign that relations between Catholics and the Orthodox Church in Cyprus are good. They are already good relations. As far as I know, there are no particular tensions, nor have there been specific tensions in recent times, in living memory. The church throughout the Middle East, on the other side of that stretch of the Mediterranean that separates the Middle East from Cyprus, relations between the Orthodox clergy, lower clergy, and faithful, and the Catholics and the Catholic Church are always friendly, as a rule. There was not in the Middle East that bitterness of willful division that was felt since the late 15th and then 16th centuries on the European part of Orthodoxy. The Eastern churches of the Middle East were represented in the Union Council of Florence in 1439 and signed on to the Union. They never willfully left the Union, but in the nature of things drifted behind the forces in Constantinople after the Turkish conquest of 1453 that brought about the eventual breakup of the restored communion. So there's no residue in the Middle East of resentment towards the Catholic Church as there might have been further along in Asia Minor or on the Greek peninsula with the memory of the 1204 events in Constantinople, or the failure indeed of Catholic Europe, of the princes of Catholic Europe, not of the Pope, but of the temporal princes, to come to the aid of Constantinople when on the final assault. So there are good relations, and there's every reason to expect that the Holy Father's visit to Cyprus will deepen them and secure them even further on the island of Cyprus, indeed.
There to Father David Jaeger, delegate to the Holy See of the Franciscan Custody of the Holy Land. He was talking there to my colleague Charles Collins, who'll be reporting for us throughout Pope Benedict's 3-day visit to Cyprus. Witnessing to Christ today is the theme of a major missionary conference taking place in the Scottish city of Edinburgh from Wednesday through Sunday this week. Hundreds of delegates from all the main Christian denominations are discussing ways of working more effectively together in spreading the gospel message. The conference draws together research and study programmes that have been going on in countries around the world and concludes with a celebration in the very same venue where the first World Missionary Conference took place exactly 100 years ago, a founding moment for the modern ecumenical movement.
Well, yes, 100 years ago, Edinburgh, 1910, became a focal point of thought and action for especially missionaries, mostly in the Protestant communities, regarding the fact that division among Christians is a scandal and makes it difficult to proclaim Christ to the world.
Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, is heading the Catholic delegation to the conference. I spoke with him just before his departure for Edinburgh to find out about his hopes for this important ecumenical encounter.
Now, 100 years later, the Catholic Church will be present, and this, of course, is due to the fact that if you go and read Unitatis Redintegratio, the document on ecumenism of the Second Vatican Council, it says there that this ecumenical movement, which began outside the Catholic Church, is a gift of the Holy Spirit. And with the Council, the Catholic Church entered fully into this search for Christian unity. Edinburgh 2010, therefore, is a gathering which is not just to celebrate what happened 100 years ago. It is, above all, to see what we have done in 100 years to actually answer the question, why are we divided? And do we not realize that this is an anti-testimony?
As you say, 100 years ago, the Catholic Church was not really part of the ecumenical movement, although there were people interested in this search for unity. Yes. How then will this conference perhaps influence the work of your council here and of the Catholic Church in a broader sense?
Well, of course, since the Council, since the Second Vatican Council, the Catholic Church is fully involved in the search for Christian unity. And this year, our Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity will be celebrating its 50th anniversary, set up by Pope John the 23rd, precisely to bring into the workings of the Second Vatican Council this concern for unity. Now, our work consists in building up relationships of trust and study and collaboration with all of the Christian bodies and churches and communities around the world. That work, of course, is helped by participation in all of these international conferences, by the fact that we can meet those responsible for the other communities, that we can develop programs to meet and to collaborate. And now, in this particular conference, Edinburgh 2010, there will be a deep and abiding reflection, which has been going on for years now in preparation, on the missionary aspect of the life of our church and the churches. Mission and ecumenism must go hand in hand, and it is absolutely necessary that in presenting Christ to the world, the churches overcome what has been a sad fact of the past, and that is rivalry and confrontation, so as to be able to speak together the message of the gospel. The purpose of ecumenism is to reach the day when we will be able to do that together.
You're going to be giving one of the presentations, aren't you, at one of the opening sessions of this conference. Can you give us just a couple of ideas, perhaps, of the message you're bringing?
Well, it will be a brief presentation. There will be a number of presentations at the first plenary meeting of the conference, and I will be speaking about mission from the point of view of the Catholic Church. Naturally, we have a long history of missionary activity going all the way back to the first Christian community. But most importantly, it will be a reflection about recent changes in the world, which change the way mission needs to be done. The foreign missions are really now at our doorstep. The concept of human rights, religious freedom, dignity, and so forth call for a new respect in the way we see other religions. So it is the great challenge of combining the mandate to proclaim the gospel with that view of the respect that we have to have for those who have other ideas. It goes back to that idea which Pope Paul VI expressed so well in Evangelii Nuntiandi, that the world will only be convinced by convincing witnesses.
There will, of course, be many, many different views, many different visions. This isn't just the major denominations. This is hundreds of churches from many different contexts and backgrounds. How difficult will it be, do you think, to really draw some effective, some powerful conclusions from such a broad panorama of different views of Christianity?
Well, this is the face of Christianity as it is divided. We won't solve all the problems in the few days of the conference. But listening to each other and hearing what God is asking of us Christians in the present circumstances of the world, hearing what he is doing through the work of committed Christians around the world, we may all have a new sense of purpose and motivation in upholding the missionary nature of the Catholic Church.
One of my senior colleagues, Bill Baker, was an observer at the Second Vatican Council, and his influence on us was tremendous to remind us of our partnership, not just within our own particular strand of confession, but really being part of the Church Universal, the Church Catholic.
Reverend Mitchell Bunting, or Bungie to his friends, is a minister of the United Reformed Church and part of the Scottish organising team for Edinburgh 2010, as this World Missionary Conference is being called. I sat down with him to talk about the goals of the meeting and the impact the first missionary conference had back at the beginning of the 20th century.
100 years after the first Edinburgh Conference, a number of mission organisations decided it was time to gather together to reflect on the past century and prepare the churches and mission agencies for the coming century. There are many major shifts and changes that have taken place, both within the church and within the world we live. So huge changes of globalisation, in some parts of the world secularisation, greater religious plurality, our understanding of our relationship with people of other faiths, these things have changed in a major way. So it's important for us to meet and try to reflect on these issues. At the same time, the fantastic change has been in the growth of churches that weren't necessarily around, or if they were around in 1910, they were very small. Particularly we can think of the Pentecostal churches, the independent churches growing in Africa, and a whole number of emergent organisations and movements. And part of the aim of the 2010 conference taking place in Edinburgh this year is to give a forum for as wide a perspective of Christian witness in the world today to come together, to share, to discuss, and to find some common commitment that will allow us to be prepared for the next 100 years of Christian witness. And the Roman Catholic Church are fully part of that preparation and that conference.
As you say, the major challenge perhaps today is an increasingly secular society, mm-hmm. simply not interested in hearing a Christian message. Yeah. What are you doing? What do you hope to achieve? What perhaps can this centenary conference offer in the way of an answer to that?
One of there were 8 commissions in the 1910 conference. This year there are going to be 9 commissions, looking at the 8 they did before and adding one more. And the additional commission is really to do with the changing context in which we're in, and will take account of the themes of secularisation and globalisation, as well as a very important theme of relationship with people of other faiths. Whereas before, a major emphasis of the church might have been to convert people of other faiths, we are now working with these communities on social political issues, and our trust and relationship with them is very different. They respect that, or some of them respect that Christians have a mandate to share our faith, but we are also looking at ways of sharing our faith that have integrity, both for ourselves and for those with whom we wish to share it, and that will include our relationship with people of other faiths. Of course, in some of our cultures, particularly in Northern Europe, we are dealing with a society that in many ways is post-Christian. Many countries have large numbers of people who do not know the basics of the Christian faith. So there's also a role for the churches to re-evangelize, to rekindle the spirit within these communities.
Back in 1910, looking back now, many people say the expectations, the hopes that emerged from that conference, and indeed some could say from the Second Vatican Council as well, were very high. And there's a lot of frustration around that they haven't been anything like achieved in that sense. How do you answer that?
In 1910, they had a slogan which I think was something like evangelizing the world, the whole world in our generation. They really had an enthusiasm, which I think came from a kind of colonial attitude that they could dominate the world and they could spread the gospel to every nation. In 1910, I'm told, the population of the world, the proportion of the population of the world that was Christian was about 30%. Now, somebody has just told me today, in 2010, the proportion of the world's population that is Christian is about 30%. So you could say it's had no impact at all. But we have to take into account various factors. One is the population has grown tremendously, so the mission societies have done their work. We've also taken into account that in some parts of the global north, the church may have declined, but in the global south, it has blossomed. And there's now a readdressing of where the centres of Christianity are in the world. And that's not a bad thing. Let's remember that our faith started in a graveyard in the Middle East. We are always changing the context. The Christianity is a moving, a living faith. The context of our mission is always changing, from first century Palestine through centres in Europe, now to centres in the global south. The Spirit is keeping us alive. It's also been noted, though, if the mission organisations had not collaborated and worked so effectively throughout the 20th century, the percentage of the world's population that confessed Christ would probably be far, far less than 30%. So that's something we give thanks to God for, that we have achieved something, just not our vision. And I would guess the other great vision was that the church would find a way of organic and visible unity. Now, we still have that as a calling, as a vision, but our way of achieving it is perhaps different. Instead of sitting in meetings trying to argue out points of faith and order, now, that has its place because we really do need to understand each other. We are perhaps putting more emphasis now, and I'm sure in 10 or 50 years there'll be a correction and these things will change again. But there now seems to be more emphasis on working together, taking guidance from God, what mission God is calling us to undertake. And that unity might be expressed in work with the world's poor, challenging political and social structures, giving a critique on the economy, as well as spreading the faith through more traditional means.
Thanks there to Reverend Mitchell Bunting, part of the organising team for Edinburgh 2010. And earlier you heard Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, who's heading the Catholic delegation to that conference. And you can find lots more information about that conference, plus follow the concluding ceremony on Sunday live on the website www.edinburgh2010.org. www.edinburgh2010.org. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, plus full details of Pope Benedict's forthcoming 3-day visit to Cyprus. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.